And tonight, what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time talking about the, let me fix this. The second rule that people have used in terms of exegesis. And the second rule, it's something that we understand and we use it all the time, but we're going to talk a little bit more about it tonight. The meaning of a word or phrase or sentence or paragraph must be derived from the context in which it occurs. Okay? Something we're all familiar with. So let's just look at an illustration. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 11. And this is Paul's discussion of the Lord's Supper. And we'll notice some things as we go through this. Now, I have the New International Translation. You may have a different translation. But the first thing that we're trying to figure out what this is all about. The first thing that we do, the thought begins in chapter 11 at verse 17, and it goes all the way down through the end of the chapter. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to look at sentences. Because all the words appear in sentences. And a sentence presents a complete thought, right? So, as you go through this, I want you to notice how often the sentences don't correspond to verses. And verses kind of get us confused. Because I want you to look, if you're looking at the New International Translation, there's a period at the end of verse 17. In the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good, period. That makes sense. Verse 18, in the first place, I hear that when you come together as a church, there are divisions among you, and to some extent, I believe it, period. Everybody with me?
Mine has a comma. Sorry.
Yours is a comma?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sorry, I mean to say that out loud.
That's the first thing that you're going to learn. Periods sometimes are commas in other translations. How do you know how long the sentence is? Okay? See, that's an interpretation that you're going to have to reach. Then verse 19. No doubt there have to be differences among you to show which of you have God's approval. Period. Right?
Question.
Yeah, go ahead.
American Standard. For me, the end of verse 18 should be continued in 19 rather than separated.
Okay. Yours has a comma there instead.
No, it doesn't. It has a period.
Oh, it has a period.
But it says, and I firmly believe it, for there must also be factions. Now, that's continuing into verse 19.
Okay.
When it says four, that's a continuation of the other sentence.
Okay. Well, hang on to that, because we're going to get, we just haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
Okay. This idea of four. Then verse 20, when you come together to eat, it is not the Lord's Supper you eat, comma, it's not the end of the sentence, it's not the Lord's Supper you eat, for when you are eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers, period. Yours is different, Eileen.
Yeah, mine's colon.
Yep.
So what does yours have? Start at verse 20.
Verse 20 says, therefore, when you come together in one place, comma, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper, period. 21 is for an eating, comma, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, semicolon, and one is hungry and another is drunk, period.
Okay. So, see, it makes a difference. How you read this, so Look at sentences first.
But it's all going to say the same thing.
I'm sorry?
It's all going to say the same thing.
Yeah, but sentences are important.
I know they're important, but I just don't see... I'm sorry, you go ahead with...
But you're right. You're right. The words are the same.
You're going to get the same...
Maybe. Maybe you will, maybe you won't.
How do you know who's right and who's wrong?
That's what you're going to have to decide. And you have to decide that on your own.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Normally, to me, the numbers are kind of irrelevant. I just continue reading.
Right.
And get the thought from the whole context until I come to a paragraph or something.
Okay, so you're reading from the American Standard.
Yeah.
So you don't pay as much attention to verses because of the formatting of the American Standard. It's formatted into paragraphs. Okay? Understand, those paragraphs are not in the original text. In the original text, it's just one, just continuous. Okay? All the way through, just so, continuous.
So like 1 Corinthians is, there's no numbers. That whole book is just continuous. No chapters.
There's no verses. There's no chapters. Right. It's just one continuous text.
Which a letter would...
Did they have any punctuation at all?
No.
It was just like one continuous sentence?
Yes. In the original language, it was one continuous sentence. But what they used some keys to try to figure it out. Usually a sentence, unless you're talking about some of Paul's sentences in Romans, usually there's a verb and a noun. So when they change to a different noun, they would change to a different sentence.
Okay. That's interesting, because it seems to me that one continuous sentence, and it makes sense of it, they had to have different brains than we have and be smarter than we are.
No, it's just a different language. It's just a different language.
Yeah.
Like if you read Spanish, a question in Spanish, the question mark is before the sentence starts. Mm-hmm. In English, it's when the sentence ends. So, you know, different languages have different rules. And in some languages, and I wish Faye was on, in some languages you have feminine nouns and you have masculine nouns. And the masculine noun always has to agree with the masculine form of the verb. And there all these rules, I don't know all those rules.
They say the English language is complicated.
Oh, to be perfectly honest, I didn't learn what an infinitive was until I studied Latin. And it occurred to me what an infinitive is. Everybody talked about it. I don't know the rules. I was taught how to speak by my mother, who was very, very precise. And so if I'm reading a sentence and it says, Ted and I went to the store, is it Ted and I went to the store or Ted and me went to the store?
Ted and I.
There are rules about which one you use. I don't know the rules. All I know to do is go by what sounds right, because that's what my mother taught me.
Well, because you would say, Ted and I go to the store, but you could also say, I went to the store. But you wouldn't say, me went to the store.
Right.
That's how I would be.
Right.
But I'm not an English teacher.
You would say, yeah, but you were, do you know all the rules about when you use the me and when you use I? It's the subjective and objective pronouns.
No, not all of them.
Oh, good grief. I don't know any of them. You know. So I just go by what sounds right to me. And sometimes I make a mistake. But that's the way I do it. So you look at sentences. Because a sentence presents a complete thought. So if you're trying to figure something out, you look at sentences. And this is not the maybe the best one to say that there, depending on where you put the period, it's going to change the thought that's being presented. Okay? And word order and all of that. I don't know if you've ever been to Amish country, but Amish people speak in a kind of weird word order.
All you got to do is go to Harrisburg.
Yeah. Amish people would say, throw mother off of the train a kiss. Instead of the way we would say it, throw mother a kiss off of the train. Okay? So they say, throw mother off of the train a kiss. You just have to figure out where sentences end. Yeah, Vicki.
So without distracting from what you're trying to, I don't know if you're through going through 1 Corinthians or not, but can you show me a side-by-side out of one translation to another translation to where the periods and commas and everything else are so different that it gives you a completely different message?
Not in 1 Corinthians.
Well, anywhere.
Yes, I can, but it gets complicated and I didn't want to get into it. I just wanted to make the point. Recognize periods and commas and where the commas are and where the punctuation is. I will show you that, okay? But it does get complicated.
I just don't think God would make it that complicated for us.
I don't think God's intention was to make it complicated. God's intention is for you to pay attention to what's going on.
I'm in an English class, not a Bible class. Yeah. And I just, so like, if, I guess if I, and at some point show me that, if I, maybe I would understand all of what you're trying to do if somebody would show me in the Bible where a period or comma completely makes it two different things.
Okay.
So you go ahead with your class.
Okay, I can. I will show you that.
Okay.
I just didn't want to get into that because I didn't want to get into arguing the specifics of whether it should be this way or that way.
Okay.
Okay. But you just have to recognize sentences. You have to recognize paragraphs. Okay. And some translation, American Standard, uses a paragraph format where the King James doesn't. There is no paragraph format in the King James. So, depending on what translation you read, it's going to be a little bit different. You have to look at a complete thought or a complete argument. It's like a complete subject. If you start reading in 1 Corinthians 11 at verse 1, you're not reading about the Lord's Supper. At some point in there, he switches from talking about what he'd been talking about earlier, which is the covering and whether or not we ought to be covered. Then it gets to verse 17, and it's like he turns a switch, and it's a different thought. Now, if you're reading in the New International Translation, they put an extra little grace note in there to say, okay, now he switches to the Lord's Supper.
Well, mine just says, first it says head coverings, and then it says conduct at the Lord's Supper, then institution of the Lord's Supper.
So yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you just understand those were supplied by somebody that read it and thought that that was where the change ought to be.
Right.
So you can generally speaking trust people of goodwill to make the best effort they can to get it right. But understand, you have to make that decision on your own. You have to decide. Do I think they got it right or got it wrong?
And it's conduct, not conduct. It's well, anyway.
That's a part of context.
And at the Lord's Supper.
Conduct.
Yeah.
I said a different word.
That's a part of context.
Yeah.
Is knowing the sentence that the concept is in, the paragraph, the whole concept that's being discussed, or the argument that's being made. And remember how often we saw Paul switching from one kind of argument to a different kind of argument as we were going through Hebrews. And he gets to this place and he starts this warning. So it's, and that's where you get the for and the therefore. Okay? So when he says for, that's how you know that he's kind of summarizing or he's introducing an argument. And then when you see therefore, that's considering what I said before, this is what this all means. Okay? So that's important. You interpret the scriptures that way. Now, a letter should be understood as a unit of thought as well. Right? So you have the first letter that Paul wrote to Corinthians, to the Corinthians. That's a unit. So you have to look at that unit to see what the import is. Suppose you were reading 1 Corinthians 11, and he says, don't you have houses to eat and drink in? Okay, what do you mean you have houses? What's a house?
Your own home.
Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's a location. Sometimes a house is a group. It's people. Like, and he only uses that word twice in 1 Corinthians. It's used 117 times in the New Testament. And you're right. In general, the meaning is location. But it also clearly, in some cases, means not location, but group. Okay, yeah, Bill.
The point for that particular thought is that these places are separated from the church. You don't do this in the church, you do it somewhere else.
Okay. Okay, that's your conclusion. In that case, house has something to do with location. Okay? Agreed. He only uses that word one other time in 1 Corinthians. And it's toward the end when he talks about the house of a particular individual. He's not talking about the location. He's talking about the group. Okay? So if you consider it as a unit, if you consider the first Corinthian letter as a unit by itself, then maybe that's going to cause you to color the way that you define this term house when he's talking about the Lord's Supper. Because if you look at the entirety of his argument there, his argument doesn't focus on location. His argument focuses on the way that you respect the members of the group. Right? This is to take this one statement out of the whole argument and turn it into a statement about location. But if you look at it in the context of his argument here in 1 Corinthians 11, it's the way that you disrespect the group. Okay.
I can't explain it, but I'm not sure I agree with you. I think that he's talking about location. rather
okay,
than...
Okay, that could be. That could be. And I'm just saying, you have to consider all of those things. And I also look at the Bible or the New Testament as a unit. Okay? And if I look at the New Testament as a unit, house, generally speaking, 117 times it's used, but most of the time it does refer to a place.
A home is a place.
I'm sorry?
A home is a place.
A home is a place. A home is also a unit of people. The household of Stephanus. Or the household of Cornelius.
Well, that's their household. That would be different than your home.
Same word in the original language, though.
Don't you have homes to eat and drink in?
Right.
That's your home.
Right.
Okay, mine says houses, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mine says houses.
Yeah. Don't you have a home? Okay. So, I'm just making the point that you have to think about, if you looked at just 1 Corinthians, you only have that word used twice. Once it's clearly the family is referring to a family unit, and he's naming the head of the family, just like he did the household of Cornelius, okay? That had nothing to do with the location. It was his household. Yeah.
Well, okay, so I can't remember why I was looking this up, but I was doing some lesson, but I looked up the Lord's Supper and its meaning and things like that, and there were some statements that said that where this is going is that where it says you eat your own supper first, meaning that when he did the Lord's Supper, supposedly, they had already eaten, and they were meeting in a meeting place, and it was just like they were gathering to have drinks and commemorate and just and do that kind of stuff. And so it was away from where they were going, and they went to somewhere, and they went upstairs. And I always think, just because of TV and movies and things, but in history of pictures, most meeting places took place above some sort of tavern or some sort of like big congregational house, and it was just upstairs because that's just how they did things. And so when I think this, it's like they just, you know, you go home and you do that at your home, and then you're here and they met at a meeting house.
Well, what this says, and I know this is man-made too, but it says the Corinthian believers were taking their own supper ahead of others, violating the spirit and purpose of the meal. In acting this way, they showed contempt for the church of God and shamed those who had nothing. Now, I don't know if that has 1/32nd to do with the houses or anything, but...
Well, if home is if you take house or home as a unit, then you're saying, if you want to eat a regular meal, eat it with your family unit.
Okay, that makes
sense. Okay. Yeah.
I know you're getting into the details here, and I just understand it the way it's hit me over the years. The church is the focus that is to be respected,
but not the
house
building.
Is someplace else that's incidental, it's anywhere else.
Right, but the thing that's respected is not the building, it's the people.
Yeah, the congregation.
Right.
It's the people.
Right.
Right.
And it's hard to get the world to understand that. I had a debate with somebody about that, and I thought I was crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Because the church is the people. The building is just a building where the church meets, the people
yeah.
meet.
Yeah.
That's something we need to understand. The church in the Bible is the people. It's not a building. It's not a place. It's the people, the congregation. That's the church. And, you know, it's not a place like this building. And that's, most of us, anybody says church, and they think it's a building.
Okay, but if You know, think about what that would mean here in 1 Corinthians 11. You're taking church to mean group. House means location. Why don't you talk about location then talk about group in the same argument, in the same context? I'm just putting it out there. It's something that we have to think about. Now, do I think there's something special about taking the Lord's Supper with the group? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in my mind, that's the real reason why they gathered, was to take the supper. Okay? So it's the gathering, not the location. It's just something to think about. I think you have to...
Can I chime in?
Yeah, go ahead.
And I think that this whole conversation is gives us a good idea about context and about how we understand. I want to get back to, I think it was Vicky that said this is more like an English lesson than a Bible lesson. And I think it's really important for us to understand that that it's not really like an English lesson. This is really how we need to come to terms with how we understand the scriptures and how we approach the scriptures and consistency and context. And we can get off into the weeds sometimes, like we did with this conversation, is we started focusing on the particulars of what we were talking about rather than understanding that what we're looking at is how some translators have taken the same words and put a period and some put a comma, and that very well could change the meaning of the thought that the apostle had. And then that would then change the way that we understand it. So I think the conversation is a good one because I think we need to think deeper and look at how we understand the Bible and what influences our thought process and how we understand the Word of God. I think this is really, really important. And 1 Corinthians 11, I think, is a really good example of really how one statement can really kind of frame an entire paradigm. And I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Now, all of that said, we need to take the first letter to the Corinthian church as a unit. We also need to take the Bible, take the New Testament as a unit, and understand the New Testament as distinct from the Old Testament. Okay? So don't switch back and forth between Old Testament and New Testament. Then you've got looking at the Bible as a whole. And now we're back to hermeneutics in some ways. It's how we treat the Bible as a whole, not a specific word or not a specific phrase. Okay? And then you've got secular language. So what this... I look at this word and I say, okay, what does that mean? Well, I can look at other places where it's used by the same author in the same book, and that's going to help me a lot. I can look at places where it's used by another different author in another different book, and that helps. And I can look at how it's used generally in the Bible, and I can look at how it is used in secular literature that's not Bible literature. Now, secular literature helps because it reminds me that I have to be aware of culture. The books in the Bible, the letters, were written to people of a particular culture. Hebrews was written primarily to Jews. Romans is written primarily to Gentiles. I mean, that's just something that has to color the way that you understand what those books are talking about. Okay? Now let me give you another illustration. Let's talk a little bit about singing. When the Apostle Paul wrote to the Ephesians and he said that you must speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. When those people heard that phrase, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart, what did that conjure up in their mind? What was singing to those people?
Chanting.
Okay, that's an interesting observation. So, the first thing we can do is we can look for some historical facts that we can use. Yeah.
Well, singing also used to be what the jesters used to do to get, like, to tell the news in some way, to, like, I think to cut the sting of what they were about to tell. So they thought that if they may put it to some sort of music or to melody, that it would soften the blow of certain news.
Okay. So that's, but the jesters, that tends to be medieval time period. We're trying to get back to what did people in Corinth in the first century think of when they heard this.
I kind of think they probably thought back to sort of their traditions and songs that had been handed down from generation to generation, and songs of praise from maybe the Psalms, maybe some things that David had written, or even prior to David, songs that were written for worship and praise to God. I think about Mary, when Mary sang the song that she sang. It was a familiar song. It was a song that Miriam had sung.
Yeah, after they crossed the Red Sea.
After they crossed the Red Sea. And so she picked up that same song and sang it in praise. So I suspect that it was something very traditional. Whatever that sounded like, I don't know. later you've got these Gregorian chants. That I don't know that it was necessarily that, but I think it was probably something that they recognized as being something very traditional to them.
Okay. We are going tonight to listen to what singing sounded like in the third century. We have a group of third century singers that were recorded on a CD. No, I'm just teasing. But I think that's a good point. And so let's look at the audience that he was writing to. So Pliny the Younger is the governor of Bithynia from 111 to 113. So this is really, really early. And he wrote letters back and forth to the Emperor Trajan so that he would be able to answer questions that arose. He's a minor provincial governor, and he doesn't want to do something that's going to get him in trouble with Trajan, because Trajan will cut his head off if he does something stupid. So every time a situation arises, he would write a letter to Trajan and say, what do I do in this situation? Trajan would write back to him. So we have this exchange that Trajan and Pliny had about, well, the real context of it is some people have been accused of being Christians. And Trajan says, What am I supposed to do with them? What should I do with these people that are Christians? And or Pliny says, what should I do with these people that are Christians? And he describes them so that the emperor will know what he's talking about. Now, this is the relevant section of a much longer letter that he wrote. And we have the letter, okay? So that's a fact, okay? That's not a story we tell about it. But this is what he says in the letter. He said, after he questioned some of these people, and some of them said, yes, they're Christians, and some said that they weren't, and some were willing to bow down to the God of the emperor, and some weren't. He says, they asserted, however, that the sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed to meeting on a fixed day before dawn and sing responsively a hymn to Christ as God. So, whatever they did, they described it in the prior to the 100s. They described it to trade or to Pliny as we sing responsively a hymn to God. Okay? Now, what does it mean to sing responsively? Well, a lot of people have told a story about that. Now we move from fact to story. And the story that they would tell about singing responsively a hymn to Christ as God is there would be one person who would call out the first line of some hymn, and then the rest of them would repeat it, and then he'd call out the second line, and the rest of them would repeat it, and then he'd call out the third line, and the rest of them would repeat it. So it was call and response. Yeah.
I once went to a Lutheran church with somebody once, and they did a responsive thing like that, which was new to me. Oh, well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that in some ways, that seems to be descriptive of what they thought it meant to sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, making melody in their heart to God. Okay? You want to know what this sounded like? Well, this is it. I found this really interesting as I was continuing my research.
Are these the third century group recorded?
There is a fragment of a song that was written on a papyrus that has musical notation with it. This dates probably to the 300s, okay? So we don't have anything that dates all the way back to prior to the 100s. We don't have anything that goes that far back, but we do have this one. And we don't have the whole thing. We only have parts of it, okay? It's kind of like the Dead Sea Scrolls. We don't have the whole book. We have parts of the book. So this is called the Oxyrhynchus Hymn. I have no idea why it's called that, but that's what it's called, and that's what it's in Greek. And you have the staff, and there's apparently some notations on the staff. So if we clean this up a little bit. Somebody cleaned it up for us, and they said, this is what it looked like. Okay? And those are the words. Or here are the words over here. The musical notation is over there, or whatever we would call musical notation. But the musical notation in this psalm that we found looks a lot like the musical notation of chanting or Gregorian chants. Okay? When you think about language, language has ups and downs in it, right? One of the things that AI is working on is the ability to make language sound like language instead of just sounding flat. Because if you're old as I am, you remember back when computer-generated speech sounded really flat. There was no up or down. There was no musicality to it. And when I was doing research on teaching children to read, we came across this idea of prosody. And prosody is reading. Most people say it's reading with feeling. Have you ever heard a really bad reader? When they read, it's just flat. They don't stop at the periods. Their voice doesn't go up when they get to a question mark. It's just flat. That doesn't help comprehension. If you read them with prosody, or you read the ups and downs of music, then it helps you comprehend what you're saying. So, I say all of that to say that for them, they were speaking to each other. And they were speaking to each other with maybe an exaggerated up and down, but that's what cantors did. Jews were intimately familiar with cantors, people that read the law. And, you know, if you went through reading the Old Testament law, you know how dry that can be. So they kind of did a sing-songy, we call it sing-songy kind of thing. But they were cantors, and it was like they were singing it. Okay, you had the ups and downs, and that's what you have here, ups and downs. But it's what typically occurs in language. And they just exaggerated it. Okay? So, have you ever heard somebody read the Bible and just the way that they read? They were reading the same words that you might have read over and over again. And they read it and their voice went up at a spot and it occurred to you, that's what that means. Well, that's what singing was. So, let me give you an idea of what this sounded like. If you're interested, there's the link that you can use to go and listen to a trained group that sang this hymn that we found. And so let me get to the internet, and I have this thing called up. Let's see, history. I want recently. Oh, I want. Okay, let me do it this way. I'll get it.
Pegai, pod amor, o Dio, ma sali.
So when they heard sing and make melody in your heart, that's probably fairly close to what they thought of.
Well, I think that's an assumption on your part, because in 300 years, our music has changed dramatically. And so 300 years is the closest there. All I get from what you said originally is it was a person who led and sang whatever they wanted the rest of the congregation to agree and sing. So you didn't have a songbook. You had a leader who led the mind and the focus. And so the group would be unified, and a stranger or a new person would still be able to sing and be included.
Okay. And in that clip that we listened to, you heard at one point there was just one voice and he sang something and then everybody else responded. But you do make a good point. Music changes in 300 years. Okay? So I can't tell you that that's what they sang in Ephesus when the Apostle Paul wrote to them and used those words. I can't tell you that. But my guess is that when they read, speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, they didn't think about what we do that we call singing. It was something very different.
You know, it's wonderful to hear that, you know, what people sounded like back then. What effect does it have on us today?
Well, there's
just sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. That's good enough for me.
Okay.
Why should I have to go back 2,000 years?
Okay.
You know, what's the purpose of that for me?
The purpose may be to say that, yeah, and this is an argument that has been made over time, that the music that we set the words to sometimes gets in the way of understanding the words.
I'm not understanding.
Okay. Let me give you an example. Silent Night. It's a song we're all familiar with. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin, mother and child. So if you sing that with the phraseology that the music demands, you miss the point. The point of that song is silent night, holy night. All is calm, all is bright round yon virgin mother and child. That's a very different understanding than what you get if you force it into the music. And a lot of people have argued that some of the Stamps Baxter songs that we sing that have all these really complicated music lines and all of that, that gets in the way of people being able to speak to each other in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. We're giving up on the idea of encouraging one another, speaking to one another, and we want this song that sounds like a song. So that's the way I see it impacting what we do.
Yeah, I just don't understand the point of researching this and applying it today. How does it apply to us today? Now, when you say these stamps, Baxter songs and that type of thing, you're right there. I mean, they're just for enjoyment. They're not for really putting out a word.
Okay.
Virgil Stamps got a little carried away once in a while.
But if that's the case,
you don't have to use those songs.
Okay. Then there are a lot of people that would read the instruction in Ephesians, and they focus on the idea of speaking to one another and don't focus so much on making sure that it's unaccompanied by any instrument. Okay? They focus on whether or not we're speaking to one another. And that makes a lot of sense to me.
Dean, there's not any song that I'm not trying to speak to other members of the congregation. I mean, my heart is praising God and speaking His word and His example and stuff. And when you talk about Silent Night, I never misconstrued the melody with the words. It was always the words.
Okay. And that's great. Some people can do that. That's great. Yeah.
Sometimes you can use the words in a song to express how you're feeling to somebody because it'd be like poetry, because that's really what all songs are. They start out as poetry readings, because I know I used to as a kid, I would take verses from songs that I thought, how I felt at the time or like what I wanted to convey to somebody else. So, I mean, you can take a song and you can break it apart and use it to express how you might feel, because maybe their words are going to help you express how you feel. So,
right.
I mean,
I agree. You make a good point. But a song like 'Tis Midnight and On Olive's Brow, when's the last time you ever said Olive's Brow or Pisgah's Brow?
Only when they sing the song.
You know why brow is in there? So it'll rhyme with now, later. We forced rhymes on it. And by forcing rhymes on it, we take away the sense of what we're saying. Or we don't communicate the sense of what we're saying. Now, can you argue that our language has become cheapened and no longer do we have beautiful language? Yes. Okay. I can rail against the fact that our language has been coarsened and now most people have a working vocabulary of about 600 words. And they respond to questions with one word. They don't respond to questions with sentences. So, yeah, I decry all of that. And above all else, I'm a person that likes words. Okay? Yeah, I mean, that's why I talk about things like perspicuity. I like words. I think words have meaning. But when you use the word, 'tis midnight on Olive's brow, nobody knows what that means. I won't say that. Not nobody. But a lot of people don't know what that means.
No, what does it mean?
And that's one reason I don't sing that song.
Okay.
I mean, I don't sing it. The other song is I'll Fly Away in the Morning, Hallelujah By and By. Why in the morning? We don't know when he's coming. So I don't
okay.
sing that song.
Okay.
So I think we really do need to pay attention to what we sing out there. Just because everybody's singing it doesn't mean it's out. Good song to sing,
yeah.
Right song to sing.
Yeah.
And I can't sing. I try not to say me and my household will serve the Lord, because I do, but not the whole household.
Okay.
That's hard for me to sing because I feel, because I've heard more than one preacher or teacher, however you want to classify hearing the Word of God, say, think about what you're singing. Mm-hmm. Think about it. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to God? And so, you know, I feel like if I sing that particular verse, I'm lying.
And I think that's the point of Ephesians 5. Okay? We read Ephesians 5 and we think we're not singing with an accompanying instrument, so we got it. And that is such a short-sighted approach to understanding Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3:16. Okay? Now, it may be true that we don't use an instrument, but that's not the point of that passage. The other one that I always think of is Night with Evan Pinion.
Dark Wings.
Yeah. Okay. Chains of Darkness. Okay, that's what Evan Pinion means.
But I got ripped on one time. A guy came up to me and really chewed on me because I led a particular song. And he didn't think that was correct. I didn't know how to respond to him at that particular time, because I was a young man, and it caught me by surprise. Now I wouldn't have any difficulty in telling him what I thought. But he came up and really ripped on me because it was years I spent in vanity and pride, caring not the Lord was crucified. He came up and he said, my son was baptized and saved when he was 9 years old. He never spent years in vanity and pride. Okay, sing months or days in vanity and pride. I don't care. It's what fits you.
Okay.
It's general. Now, if you don't want to sing a verse, then that's okay with me. We've gotten in to the point. And I'm not deriding the ideal or anything like that of singing every verse in the song. It's got five verses, you sing five verses. It's got four, you sing four. And I don't see that that always breaks up the meaning of a song if you skip a verse.
Do you remember Dan May saying?
No, well, Dan May was the one that dumped us about it.
He said, I sure hate to be, verse 3 or something. I can't remember how
he got the point across, though, that he didn't think it was right missing a verse.
Oh, well, I didn't think he was being that dumbfounded, I got a kick out of it.
Yeah.
So he was being dumbfounded. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I just thought he was...
Yeah. I just think that if we're going to think about biblical information, we need to think seriously about what that's saying. And I think we do. We just don't always do it. Okay?